Hello, book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novel Atomic Anna. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me and you get tired of seeing the same titles on every bestseller list, you're in the right place. Because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. And remember that you heard them here first. Today, Karan Mahajan and his new novel, The Complex. This book moves between the U.S. and modern India by focusing on one family, most of whom live in a shared building, The Complex. There are many, many layers to that title, and we'll unearth them all later. I have been obsessed with Karan Mahajan since his last book, The Association of Small Bombs, and I am so, so excited to have him on my show today. Karan, welcome to Check This Out.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel. It's great to be here.
I'm just so excited to have you and to talk to you about this amazing new book, The Complex. So the title has a lot of different layers. It is a complex book. It is about a complex. How do you describe it most simply? What is the book about?
So the book is about this large family in Delhi that lives in this single pressure cooker of a compound, the complex of the title, as you were mentioning. And the ways in which the dynamics in that family change as members of the clan go abroad and then come back. And I think it's also very much a novel that is interested in the ways in which reactionary thinking festers within families before it bursts onto a more national stage.
And this family, this large sprawling family, we follow them through many years. They are complex and they live in the complex. So can you describe in your own words what the complex is?
Yeah, so it's the compound in a part of North Delhi, which was built by the patriarch of this family, S.P. Chopra, who was a great freedom fighter. And his many descendants, he has 9 kids, they live in a series of interconnected apartments. And so really everyone is on top of everyone else. People are vying for space, for control, for power. No one in the family has done as well as S.P. Chopra, so they're all desperately trying to make the family great again, often in the worst ways. And then as you hinted, like the word complex is important because it's also about the various complexes that these characters suffer.
Take us even deeper into the complex. Like we're in India, we're in a section of Delhi. Like what does it look like? It's 2 buildings. Like put us in the moment.
Sure. So it's 1980 in India, which is when this novel is occurring. And you can try to imagine it's New Delhi at a time which is still kind of socialist. So there's only 2 or 3 brands of cars. There's 1 TV channel. It's a place that's bustling but doesn't have global brands. And then you have this family living in a fairly genteel neighborhood full of whitewashed bungalows. And they have these 2 brick buildings that they live in that are built side by side. You can kind of imagine this kind of rough textured brick. And they essentially have fully identified themselves with this fancy address in their minds. And so the complex becomes an embodiment, not just of their patriarch, but also of their own self-esteem.
And then parts of the building have more sun than other parts, and some family members have bigger units, some a share, right? There's a lot of complexity within the living situation itself too there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think there's a line I have in the novel, which is, to live in the complex was to be insecure. It was to know that real estate was fate. And, you know, if you have 9 children, 6 of them sons, these sons are going to be vying for control. And obviously the older sons get better plots or better apartments in the complex. The ones who are younger might be stuck sharing a space with someone else. And so you have the situation where different generations of the family are also just living in the same quarters sometimes. And that's where a lot of the drama of the family emerges in this novel, is that what happens when there are no boundaries? I mean, I really think the novel could have been called Boundaries, just because none of these characters have boundaries.
That's great. I can see that. That would be a great title too. My guest today is Karan Mahajan. We're talking about his brand new novel, The Complex. So we have a very big, sprawling family, but to tell the story, you really start small. And we start with Sachin and Gita, and you take us to a very small piece of this family. Could you read for us and start to introduce us to these two characters?
Sure. So Sachin is the grandson of S.P. Chopra, who is one of India's political architects. And he has immigrated to the U.S. to do a master's in engineering and now is living there and working for a packaging company. And his wife, Gita, you know, he meets her in Delhi and she moves to the U.S. And this part of the novel is a reflection by Sachin on what exile has done to him and also to his marriage. And so I'm just going to read a little part of it so you can get a flavor of the novel. When Sachin had arrived in the U.S. in 1974, he'd been a shy, grieving young man. His father, a civil engineer at a government-run housing finance company, had died suddenly of a stroke before Sachin had left for his master's. In this new nation anyway, Sachin had no family to speak of. He was a man without a past. The lack of a past in America was a kind of freedom, but it meant everything was up to you. After his master's, the job at Trident had not come easily. When he had applied the first time for a summer job, he received a cyclostyle letter informing him that there were no vacant positions. He planned to stay on at Brooklyn Poly for his PhD. He had enough credits and had been granted a teaching assistantship. But then, against the wishes of his advisor, he decided to drop out. After all, he'd never even wished to be an engineer. He'd only done it to please his grandfather, the great S.P. Chopra, who was also dead. Why was he trying to please the dead? He drove cabs for 2 months in Newark, where you didn't need a green card to become a cabbie, and bemused and scared, ferried the human cargo of the city behind his tensed back, his eyes and ears and nose absorbing every twitch, perfume, and snore emanating from the back seat, wondering on the one hand what his family might think if they learned he had gone to America to become a mere chauffeur, and thinking on the other, but this is freedom. I could be killed by any of these fast-talking passengers, shot in the back, and I would vanish from the record of the universe, and yet this is freedom. His mother would mourn his loss, it was true, but the family was big enough to absorb casualties. Being born into the Chopra clan was no different from being an immigrant here. You were a prized nobody. He had been free from the moment he'd been born, or more precisely, from the moment his father had died.
Thank you for reading, Karan. I really love that passage, and in particular, this question of, you know, why do you feel a responsibility to please the dead? His grandfather does not exist, and yet in this book, character after character is trying to live up to the past and the dead. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, I think it's a symptom often in families where you have a great figure looming over future generations. I mean, we see this in shows like Succession or in movies like The Godfather, right? But I was also really interested in the ways in which that kind of feeling translates onto a national stage, right? So you have in the US people who want to make America great again, and they're hearkening back to an imagined past. And what happens in this novel is that everyone wants to make the family as great as it was when S.P. Chopra, the patriarch, was around. And so in their minds, they're always in competition with him or always trying to live up to him. And in a strange way, their minds are turned backwards instead of forwards where they should be. And that's where a lot of the problems start to emerge in this novel, is that when you become obsessed with, say, protecting the family name or like protecting the name of the patriarch, then you can't look clearly at the bad things that are happening in your family. You have to cover them up. And so this is actually, Sachin is actually like a rare, decent example of this, where he's actually turning it into, you know, a form of pressure on himself, which gets him to do work and to engage with this engineering job. But even there, as I point out, there's a kind of contradiction where he isn't quite conscious of why he's doing these things. It's kind of happening in a default way.
Yeah, and Sachin sort of lives in an in-between. He's in America. He goes to Michigan. He's in the U.S., but he has sort of one leg still back in India with his family in the complex. And one of the ways that we see that most clearly is his wife, Gita. So introduce us to Gita and that character.
So Gita really is the character who started off the novel for me. She was the person I had when I was thinking about the complex, you know, almost 10 years ago. And that's because she embodies a dilemma that I myself have really faced as someone who grew up in India and moved here at the age of 17, which is that when you come here as an immigrant, you always hold on to this fantasy that you're going to move back to your home country. You sometimes hold on to that fantasy for decades, as someone like myself has. And what happens in Geeta's case is that she is an educated woman in Delhi. She has a job in publishing. She moves to the US in 1977 and realizes that actually her degree in India, her job in India is not translatable to a good job in the US. She starts longing for home. She's unable to conceive, so that's one more kind of void in her life. And when she moves back to India, she runs into all sorts of trouble with her husband's extended family. And so now she's suddenly suspended between both countries. She's neither happy in the US nor in India, and she doesn't know where she can go. And that's a state I really recognize. And so for me, in some ways, Geeta is the emotional engine of the novel, around whom all these other characters start to revolve, including a character I'm sure we'll get into, Lakshman Chopra, who is kind of the antagonist.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Karan Mahajan. We're talking about his brand new novel, The Complex. But I want to spend some more time with Geeta. I love that she is so close to your heart and that this is really where it started, because I felt like she was, for me also, she was really the heart of the novel, the way that I got into this family. And I felt for her because she fell in love with Sachin through these letters while she was living in India and he was in the U.S. And she came to the U.S. thinking she was going to have, you know, the big dream life. And, you know, I think, of course, the dream is always better than the reality, right? She shows up and actually life is not perfect in many, many levels, including the fact that they can't have children. Let's dig into that a little bit more, this idea that there's a dream, because at the same time, when she's in the U.S. dreaming, she dreams about India and how much better it might be to go back and be with her family, right? Like there's sort of never a settled state there.
I love that you cottoned on to that, because that is something that happens, right? You always imagine that your life will be better somewhere else. And I have this line in the novel, which is, pain knows no country. You think you're going to move somewhere and your life is going to change, or your personality is going to change. And then you arrive, and of course, you're carrying all the baggage you once had. And so, one of the things that is also disillusioning for Geeta, as you pointed out, is that she has this wonderful courtship over letters with Sachin. And then she arrives in the US and she realizes, okay, this is one man, he's kind of work obsessed. He's not going to be enough as a system of meaning for me. You know, I don't have a job yet. As you pointed out, we're not being able to have kids. And so she suddenly starts longing for the crowdedness of India and the intensity of the family interactions in India, which of course is not quite accurate, in the sense that, you know, those interactions can be really fraught and unsettling as well. So you now have this person who does not have a safe space she can go to. Sachin, for example, becomes obsessed with working on this ketchup bottle for his company that has the perfect squeeze. And strangely, that is at least a place he can go to in his mind where he's safe, right? And Geeta doesn't have that. So to me, again, like, she is really crucial, because she has to then kind of figure out how she's going to make meaning for herself. And it takes her a long time. It takes her the 450 pages in the novel to figure out how she's going to do that.
Yeah, but and I was so fascinated with the character of Hector, and how you brought him in as maybe a way to anchor her, which of course he didn't at all. So tell us about Hector and that interaction.
No, so again, great that you're bringing up Hector, because Hector is, a Mexican immigrant, an educated Mexican immigrant in the town of Midland, in Michigan. So it's a fairly remote town where Geeta and Sachin live. And Geeta, at this point in the novel, has, you know, been the victim of a sexual assault by a member of Sachin's family, and she is really flailing in many ways. And she doesn't feel her marriage is working, and that she can really tell anyone what has happened, because this is the 1980s, and a time when an Indian woman would feel shame about being a victim rather than, you know, be able to talk about it with people. And she's been looking for meaning only in India, like, you know, Indians in the US, Indians in India. And she comes across this man who she's friendly with, who is another immigrant, and they actually have a kind of banter and a kind of connection that feels safe, precisely because it's not being predetermined by Indian social relations or class or the caste system. And I think, yeah, it's a very sweet moment in some ways, even though she is, quote unquote, doing something wrong, right? She's going outside her marriage. It's an attempt by her to make meaning. And I think that certainly it could have been a relationship that would have worked out in different circumstances. And of course, it doesn't. And that becomes a reason Geeta and Sachin start moving back to India as well.
Yeah, but I felt like Hector was a safe space, a part of the dream for her where she could be something else. And then it all shattered this moment when he said to her, next time wear your sari. And it was like, wait, maybe this isn't the relationship that she thought she had.
Well, I think it is interesting that I had to walk a fine line with someone like Hector, where I was thinking, okay, this is a man again in the 1980s, and he's going to have things and approaches and ideas that are fairly sexist as well, right? This is true of all the male characters in the novel. And it's true of some of the women in the novel too, who are actually anti-feminist. And yeah, Hector exoticizes her, but somehow the exoticism feels safer than if a white person is doing it, precisely because Hector's English is not that good. He's, you know, he's from a place that is more like India. And so that becomes, in my mind, actually kind of playful, because also one thing that was really fascinating when I was interviewing Indian immigrants about that period in time, the 1980s, they would all say, oh, there was no racism at the time. And actually, that's not because there wasn't racism. It's because they were choosing not to see it, or they were, you know, they were the first generation to be here after LBJ passed the 1965 Immigration Act, and they felt some kind of sense of enormous gratitude where they didn't want to bring up the negatives. And so again, I think Geeta would downplay that a little bit in the novel, even though it is by today's standards something we would see as fairly exoticizing.
Right. And also, I love that you're bringing this up, that the immigrants from the 80s were saying they didn't see racism, because really that, right, we see a cultural shift to today. And part of writing and part of why novels are important is it can show those cultural shifts, right? You have a lens there that you can show us what it was like to be an immigrant in the 80s and what that feeling was that we don't have today.
And that was one of the hardest things about the novel, honestly, is trying to capture accurately and honestly what people's attitudes were in the 1970s and 80s, because it's very easy to start inflecting them with our current moment. You know, when I'm writing about a woman who's a victim of sexual assault, I would write her very differently if she was a character who existed in 2026, right? She would maybe be able to have a language to talk about it on the internet or with a friend or to call out the person. And I had to do a lot of research about that and talk to Indian women and talk to therapists about what someone would have done in the 1980s and the ways in which they would have held on to their shame. And the same with the way immigrants refused to see or claim they didn't see racism. You know, today that would be unthinkable, right? But I thought to myself, okay, like, if that's the case, and they're refusing to talk about it, in what ways are they internalizing that feeling and kind of letting it fester inside them? And you start seeing that with a character like Sachin, who does well professionally in the US, but actually has this real chip on his shoulder where he thinks they're only going to promote the white guy over me, or I'm not getting as much credit as I should have gotten. But again, he won't always couch it in the language of race. And that's really interesting.
Yes. And this idea of couching it within the language of race, I thought really came to the forefront when he walked in to talk to his boss to say he was leaving and he was going to India. And the boss says, oh, we were wondering when that was going to happen. Right. And then he sort of straightens up and says, actually, I mean, what can we do to keep you here? Right. Right. But that first reaction was very different and very 1980s.
I'm so delighted that you've read the novel so closely and saw that section, because yes, like, that's an example of feeling othered, or what we would today call a microaggression. But at the time, Sachin wouldn't quite have words to explain why he's feeling so upset by that, right? And it is this feeling of like, oh, actually, you didn't see me as someone who was a vital part of this company forever. You saw me as an interloper. And so similar things like that happened to him over time. And I wanted to find a subtle way of dramatizing it.
I just think it's fascinating. What really, really drew me in is I'm loving this conversation because this idea that we have different ways of talking, right? Vocabulary has changed around experience. So we use words like microaggression and racism, right? Whereas Sachin, when he's sitting there in that office and he's saying, you know, he feels disappointment and he sort of deflates. Right, but I love books and novels are this chance to show how much our vocabulary and thinking has changed without necessarily saying, you know, putting any sort of value on it. But marking this change, I think, is so important.
Absolutely. And another example that comes to mind from the novel is that, you know, Sachin in his company is one of the only Indians, because this is, again, Midland, Michigan. And other people in the company are trying to christen him Sasha because it's easier to pronounce than Sachin. And he starts bullying them in turn and giving them strange names. But again, you know, today that wouldn't happen. Today it just wouldn't be acceptable to essentially erase someone's ethnic markers, right? But yeah, one reason I have the novel begin with a prologue, in a sense, chapter zero, in the present or in 2016 or so, is to mark that change, is that you suddenly have a character who's talking about the internet and about the rise of Hindu nationalism today and is using a different kind of language. And then you go back so that the contrast becomes more evident over time, that you're now in a world where Indians would call home once every month or 2 months at most. They would communicate via letters. The loneliness was much more intense. There wasn't connectivity. And so it led to a completely different immigrant experience.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Karan Mahajan. We're talking about his brand new novel, The Complex. So The Complex is a building that is in Delhi in India. We are in the 1980s, a very different time, and we are really focusing on a large, sprawling family called the Chopras. And we've been talking for a while about Geeta and Sachin, and now we are going to move to the next big looming character who in many ways is the center of the novel, but doesn't really become the center until you're about a third of the way through the book. And we're talking about Lakshman, of course. So, Karan, introduce us to this character. Tell us about him.
Yeah, a friend of mine, he read a draft of the novel, described Lakshman as a creep who creeps up on you in the novel. And I think that's fairly accurate, that he is the youngest son of S.P. Chopra and a predatory failed man who has been running this bobby pin business that is not taking off and is desperate for power at any cost. And he sexually assaults Geeta when she's on a visit back to India, and later on ends up becoming involved in right-wing politics and becoming a figurehead in the family. And so, to me, he was a really surprising character because I hadn't anticipated writing from his perspective. But as I got into his perspective in the novel, I saw the ways in which he represented our current moment of right-wing nationalism. That, you know, he embodies the patriarchy, he embodies patriarchal attitudes. And I wanted to see how that might play out beyond the family as well, if he was given a chance. And it posed a real challenge, but I'm sort of glad I'm able to have the perspective of both the victim and the perpetrator in a way in my novels. That's something I did in my last novel, The Association of Small Bombs, because it adds a sort of layer of complexity to the story. And also it brings people directly into the discomfort of the book too, which I like doing as a writer.
But you did it. I love that description. It's perfect that he's the creep that creeps up on you. Because, you know, I didn't realize, right, you sort of wove him in so slowly but beautifully. And then he came in and I kept thinking to myself, he's a little man and he doesn't have power. And yet he has so much power over the family. So how does a character who is, you know, he has financial troubles, right? He's sharing an apartment. He really doesn't have much in the world. How does someone like that loom so large over this family?
Well, if there's one thing I've learned, it's that shamelessness is a superpower. And Lakshman feels no shame about the bad things that he does. And as a result, he's able to move forward constantly. He's not reflective. You know, he'll hurt someone and then move on to the next person he can hurt. And it makes sense in a way that someone who's powerless would exert power over the people who are even more powerless in the family, which is the women, right? So he sees an opportunity there to, you know, essentially either assault or get sexually entangled with them, and they don't have a real recourse. And actually, the fact that the family starts covering up for him shows him that what he's doing is palatable and actually could become a way of life for him. And so that is the way in which Lakshman becomes a more central character despite having no actual power.
One of the things that I thought was interesting around his character was the way that he described the servants and his interactions with them, because he was a predator and he raped several servants. And the way that Lakshman described it was just like a sentence or two, right? Like, oh, yeah, and they didn't mind when, you know, when I did force myself on them. Moving on, I'm doing blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there was this sort of side note that kept coming up about servants in his life and in the complex in general, right? Which I thought was interesting because in many ways this book is a reflection on power. What is power? And yet we didn't see much a light shone on the servants. So I want to talk about them. And I talk about them in relation to him because he always just saw them on the periphery, and yet they enabled a lot of his life. Can we talk about the servants and the role that they're playing in this book?
Yeah, I'm chilled that you brought up that particular line about Lakshman and the servant girls, because it is the worst misuse of power in some ways in the novel.
Yes.
But this is a tricky thing about writing from the perspective of someone who is quote-unquote bad or quote-unquote evil, is that I think the way that they operate is through intense compartmentalization, that they will commit a crime and then they go on and live a normal life, right? They might be interacting with people like us. They might be the leaders of our country. They might be, you know, they might have a loving relationship with their child. And so it seems accurate to his psychology that he would not give a second thought to it. Now, the larger question of servants is a really interesting one, because they're ubiquitous in a family like this. They are really holding it up. They're doing the cooking, often the cleaning. The women are also engaged in that in this family. But one reason I didn't get too deep into their lives is that I think this family doesn't see them anymore. And I'm writing from their perspective, they see them as just kind of being around. And my philosophy when writing this novel was to only include people who were kind of relevant to the plot, because it's already such a crowded novel. And also that the fact that showing this offhanded attitude towards them actually captures accurately what it's like to be a person of this class in India, which is to have no pity for your servants. And actually, that later in the novel, when Geeta is in India and is employing a domestic worker and paying the domestic worker a decent wage and letting the domestic worker eat the food that the domestic worker has cooked for her, the other women in the complex start saying, look, you're going to force us to have to pay our servants more, and we're going to have to feed them good food now. And so again, the novel's really interested in the ways in which, like, even the women who are victims in, on a level, victimize their servants. And so it's passed all the way down in a way that's really sad. But I have wanted to write a lot more about servitude in India. In fact, my wife and I spent a few months a couple of years ago researching the subject and talking to lots of domestic workers. So I'm interested to see what emerges from that.
I can't wait to read that. I want to see more about it, because I also felt like it was very true to the 80s, the way that Lakshman thought about them, that your characters interacted with them in the book itself. But they were quietly there, but always there for me in every scene. So I want to go back to Lakshman, and I want to talk about his movement to the far right. Or, I don't know, I sort of felt like it was his finding some power, finally, for him. Let's talk about that. Introduce us to that movement for him.
So Lakshman oversees in the novel this temple that belongs to a reformist sect of Hinduism. And one of the reforms this sect had enacted is, we're going to have less idol worship. It's going to be less ornate. You know, there's not going to be many gods on the walls here. You're going to come in and you're going to worship fire, essentially. But because it's such a non-idol worshipping sect, people don't come to this temple much at all. And he kind of has free run of it. So he's involved already in the infrastructure of Hinduism at this point. And eventually he moves away from that into the progenitor, what is the progenitor of Hindu nationalism, which is this more ornate form of Hinduism called Sanatan Dharma, which would be familiar to Indian readers, not necessarily to American readers. And from there, because he's also becoming increasingly suspicious of Western science and has started manufacturing Ayurvedic bombs, not bombs, is what I have to constantly say, he starts finding a market among Hindu nationalists as well for his product. So all these things lead him into this nascent movement. But to me, the most interesting thing is that he enters it out of opportunism at first, because he is just a pure opportunist, but ends up actually adopting the ideology. And for me, that was a really powerful part of the novel, where he thinks to himself, oh my God, I have become a real person now. I actually believe in something finally.
But let's go back to the balms, not bombs, that he is in, right? B-A-L-M-S, not B-O-M-B-S. And because I thought it was interesting that he got swept up into, like, creams, basically, right? And this idea of sort of health and well-being when he was so rotten in the core, right? Like, he wants to make other people feel better, but he's like a black fungus. I don't know. Like that juxtaposition, right, was crazy. Let's talk about that for another minute.
I didn't even think about that, but that is very funny and very true, is that he, again, is one of those small-time operators who is trying to use whatever little power he has to show that he has power. So he's constantly saying to people, oh, you're suffering from, you're dealing with infertility. I'll take you to my healer, who has the right kind of balms and medicines that you can have. And of course, like, no woman actually wants to go with Lakshman to see anyone, right?
No.
But it's a way for him to kind of get into these situations with people where they are beholden to him. Right. And in fact, an affair that he has with another character in the novel, Karishma, who is a major character too, starts because he takes her and her son to this healer, and the son has been quite sick, and the son gets healed. And so suddenly, Karishma feels indebted to him and feels gratitude towards him. And of course, Lakshman being Lakshman, immediately tries to seize on it for his own personal gain.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Karan Mahajan, and we are talking about his brand new novel, The Complex. So we are digging into the Chopra family. They are a sprawling, multi-generational family living in Delhi. Some are living in the U.S. They come back. And I want to talk about this dynamic between the West and India, these two countries, because Lakshman in particular is a character who seems to have this love for the West and resentment at the same time, right? And he holds them both, I think, just as dearly in his heart. Is that right? Can we talk about that?
A lovely question, and yes, that is absolutely right, because what I was trying to show, again, not very consciously, but through these characters, was that India had a very tortured relationship to the West in the 1970s and 80s, which is that, on the one hand, it understandably resents the West. It's a post-colonial country, right? It's suspicious of the West. On the other hand, because India was a socialist mixed economy, people in the middle class often felt quite deprived in terms of the fact that they had a tough time buying a car. There'd be a huge long wait list. There would be a long wait list to get a telephone connection. You would want your relatives from the West to bring back Toblerone chocolates and to bring back fancy brands, to bring back gadgets that you couldn't get over here in India. And that, in a character like Lakshman, leads to all sorts of complexes vis-a-vis Gita and Sachin, who for him come to represent the success of the West. Though, of course, we know as readers, this is one of the ironies that the novel is playing with, is that Gita and Sachin are in the West and don't feel themselves to be particularly successful, or Gita at least is not happy, right? So you have these different layers of unhappiness, but people are looking at each other and thinking the other person is happy. And the word complex obviously comes up in this context a lot.
It does. And I love that we're back with Gita, because she was definitely one of my favorite characters. And at one point, she says something to the effect of, if you are in the U.S. and you go back to India, it means you've failed. right? Like you only return if you just haven't made the money, you haven't gotten the job, right? If you're successful, you stay. Let's talk about that observation and that feeling too, because there's a lot of resentment built into that.
Absolutely. So, and that was also very true again in the 70s and 80s, where because the gulf between the standard of living in India and the US was so vast, the idea that someone would actually come back and be able to tolerate the filth and the corruption and just the lower quality of job opportunities would suggest to people who are looking on from India that this person had failed or something really bad had happened to them in the US. What's interesting is that this kind of changed in the 2000s, right? Because the Indian economy starts booming, it becomes a place where many interesting things are happening. People do want to move back at that time. So again, to return it to a point that you had raised, the novel is trying to show us the ways in which those attitudes have altered over time as well. And also to show that the dream of the West, which once existed in the 80s, doesn't really exist anymore in the same way.
I think that on this topic, you bring up a really good question in the book, which is, what do you owe a country? And I was wondering if you could read from the passage where you write about that in the book.
Okay, great. But really, Sachin was thinking, could he forgive Geeta? What would that forgiveness look like? So much of his introspection happened in his rattling Pontiac on his drives to work. The gears shifted, the car went silent, a higher speed was achieved. He felt at one with his car, and sometimes he thought the car, which had never betrayed him, was his best friend. On these drives to Midland, where horse pastures were giving way to malls and motels, his friend Rishabh's words rang in his head. Remember what you always told me? Go there, make your money, but our ultimate responsibility is to this country. It needs us. If people like us go, what future does it have? But did one really owe a country, Sachin wondered. A country didn't have feelings, did it? He had studied hard, no one had helped him. Well, maybe Vibha and Lakshman when he was leaving, but that was it. Friends and family members had only tried to pull him down. And what could one man do to change the future of a nation?
I love those questions. What can one man do, and what do you owe a country? What do you think? Talk about this.
No, this is very specific, I think, to the neuroses of educated, privileged immigrants who come from poorer countries to richer countries in the West. Because you're so privileged in your country of origin, the way Sachin is, that you know that you could actually play an integral role in helping others or in uplifting others, right? And so there's a part of you that thinks that you've kind of sold out by going to the West. I certainly have that feeling at times. On the other hand, the reality of a place like India is that it's incredibly frustrating. Like, you can dream about changing it, you can dream about having an impact, but most people would go back to a place like India, try to engage with its social problems, and then give up, right? So Sachin is caught in that web or in that nexus of feelings. And we also know as readers that Sachin is not exactly street smart and not exactly the kind of person who'd be able to navigate the complexities of India that Lakshman, who is like just corrupt from the get-go, can navigate. And so Sachin is plagued by these problems, and especially because his grandfather did so much for the country. And it becomes, again, a reason why he's suspended and then considers going back.
And it really brings us back to this question, I think, of what do you owe a country, or what we started this interview with, what do you owe the dead, right? Am I doing this for my dead grandfather? Am I doing this for India? Or when do we do stuff that is just for me?
Again, like, really thank you for such a wonderful reading of the novel. It's true that this novel is about how you can become an individual in the middle of a crowd. And one of the problems of a kind of oppressive family structure is that no one has privacy and no one is able to fully express themselves, right? And so even a character like Sachin, who goes abroad, or Geeta, who leaves India and joins Sachin, even these characters who have found a way to become quote-unquote individuals are still very much defining themselves in terms of the crowd they have left. They're thinking about what they owe their family members, they're thinking about what they owe their country, they're thinking about what they owe the patriarch. And that is, in some ways, not a bad thing, because thinking about what we owe others is a good quality, but it tips over into something bad when it's happening just reflexively. and you're doing it because you are cowed by this larger structure. And I think the journey that Geeta and Sachin go on is very much a journey of figuring out who they are as individuals. And the journey that Lakshman goes on is trying to find a private space in which to enact his worst impulses. And those two streams come to a head at the end of the novel and when they intersect.
Yeah, and I think what really resonates in this book is that it's very specific. We're in 1980s India, right? For most of the time, we're in the past, but actually there's this universal question that we keep coming back to of, how do you find yourself, either as a parent, as a child, in the world, right? And in your country, like, who do you owe? This is a universal question. And when do you say, this is just for me? And I think that's why this book is really resonating, has resonated with me, I think.
Yeah, and when you say that, I'm thinking also of someone like Geeta, who, for a fair portion of the novel, is grieving the fact that she and her husband haven't been able to conceive. This is a period before IVF. And over time, we begin to realize that it's not even clear if she necessarily is obsessed with kids or wanted them, but it's something that's socially implanted in her. And the novel starts to question how our wants and desires are formed. What are our actual true wants and desires? And again, Geeta is able to come to an understanding of why she personally would like to have a particular kind of family, not just live up to some standard that has been set for her. And of course, a standard that is very stifling, especially for women in the 1980s.
Right, because I think even at one point she says something to the effect of, maybe I only wanted children because I was failing at it.
Yes, and I think that in my research on infertility, I read several books about it. I talked to people, I talked to therapists. That is something that comes up again and again, which is that the more you can't have something, the more you want it. And then that can become its own feedback loop. And breaking out of it is extremely tough. And I really feel for both Geeta and Sachin in the novel.
Yeah. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. My guest today on Check This Out is Karan Mahajan. We're talking about his brand new novel, The Complex. Karan, let's switch gears a little bit, but I understand that you spent 10 years working on this book and you did research in multiple continents. Tell us about this research. I mean, it seems like an enormous effort that you put into getting this time period and the attitudes right.
Oh my God, yeah, it makes me sort of shiver to think I spent 10 years on this. But I do feel that at the end of it is very much the book I had wanted to write. And the research was complicated because, as you point out, there was Midland in the 1980s as the lives of Indian immigrants. And then there's very micro stuff that's happening in the Delhi of the 1980s in the Punjabi community specifically, to do with, again, sexual power, patriarchy, the lives of women, then the political movements that are happening. And really, what always helps in these situations is just talking to people. I found that book learning is good, historical research is interesting, but the kind of details you get from people. So, for example, I write about the Mandal Commission protests, which were these anti-affirmative action protests that happened in India in 1990. And many people I spoke to who are now liberal and on the left, when they were in college, had participated in these protests because it was kind of defined by class. And so hearing their perspective on how they entered into this kind of misguided alignment against people who are lower caste gave me such insight into a character like Mohit, who is another character who comes up later in the novel. That's really one of the pleasures of writing novels. I'm sure you feel this way too when you write, which is that even if a novel doesn't work, one feels that one has learned so much just by listening to other people's stories.
But also, you learn to write through them and to find the story, right?
Yeah, well, what ends up happening is that you accrete all this detail. You have this cloud of research and of thoughts, and then you cut through it with your own instinctive feeling about the problem, though. Only the things that stick to your particular consciousness emerge. So 99% of research is discarded, but it gives you this authority in writing about the period, which readers can then feel.
I just want to emphasize that 99% of research is discarded, but it still lives in your head, right? It's you, to create 1980 Delhi, it's all it built into this box, even though you feel like you're throwing out 99% of it.
Yeah. I mean, totally. The way I write is that I will read all the research and then I put it aside and don't look at it again. And then I let my mind do the sifting. And of course, you know, when you talk about 1980s Delhi, I grew up in Delhi. I know that period from my childhood. I was born in 1984. So the texture and smells and feel of the landscape is there. But what I didn't know is what was happening around me as like a five-year-old or as a six-year-old politically, right? So I'm also filling in all these areas of darkness that exist in my own background, trying to understand the society that I grew up in and also its relationship to the West, which is a society that I live in. And so for me, this novel is really personal. It was really important to write because I wanted these two worlds to coexist with each other in the novel, even if it's a painful coexistence.
It feels personal. I think you did it. It really feels personal, like it came from your heart. And what do you want us as readers to be thinking when we put this book down?
I think the thing that I really want people to be aware of is that all sorts of terrible experiences and good experiences just coexist in life, that you have these dark threads and these bright threads that run through your life, and that you should look at all of them with as much clarity as you can. A natural impulse for someone like me would have been to say, I'm not going to write a character like Lakshman because Lakshman gives me the shudders. These people exist. They live among us. They are part of our experience. And one should try to look at it as carefully as possible, not necessarily empathize, but to at least understand how someone like this functions and to be able to see their worldview so that you can then actually move away from it.
Right, and to acknowledge that this is what our world is made of, right? It is not perfect. There are all of these bad pieces and good pieces that come together.
Absolutely.
So you teach at Brown, so you have lots of writing students, and I'm sure people ask you all the time, but I really want to know, what kind of advice do you give for new writers or to your students who are trying to write novels?
Oof, writing novels is such a pain, as you know very well. I wouldn't wish it upon anyone, actually, but if they insist they want to write novels, what I tell them is that you should, for your first draft, just be as instinctive as possible. I handwrite, for example, because I find that I'm less judgmental and less critical of what I've written. And also, I can get up the next day, type out what I've written, and then go back into the flow of the novel. So following your instincts, just going where that goes, writing a messy first draft, and then sculpting it, I think is a useful piece of advice. And I also tend to say to people that you should really try to think about whether the world has truly changed at the end of your novel. That's the difference between a short story and a novel, is that in a short story, it can just be a thought that has changed. But in a novel, you want to get to the end and feel that an entire system of thought has come to an end, or a system of meaning has come to an end. And that, I think, is the harder thing to pull off. And that's one of the things that I teach in a class, like, which is called structuring and destructuring novels, is helping students figure out these playful forms they can use that aren't the classic, you know, beats of screenwriting, but are actually vessels in which they can pour their most intimate thoughts.
And has the world changed in your book?
Yes.
I really like that as a guiding principle, because I think that is the essence. That is really what makes a book, right? You show change.
Right, exactly.
Karen Mahajan, I had such a blast, and I love this book, The Complex. Thank you so, so much for joining me here today on Check This Out.
Thanks so much, Rachel. It was wonderful talking.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You have been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Speaking of, Kiara Alegria-Hudes was on the show last season. And since being on the show, her book, The White Hot, was named a best book of the year by over a dozen big, big publications, and she made the list for the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. The book is absolutely amazing. Congratulations, Kiara. If you haven't read her book yet, check it out and listen to the episode wherever you get your podcasts or on nhpr.org. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission, is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by C&S Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thanks so much for listening. Read on.